Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to our second week of our contemporary halacha shir, and we are speaking about abortion this week, the Jewish perspective. I put the source sheet that I'm going to be using in the chat there on Zoom for those of you who are online, and so feel free to click on that. Like last week, we'll reference it, but we're not going to be heavily inside. We'll mostly try to keep the conversation outside. A couple of quick disclaimers before we talk about this very parv topic of abortion. And that is, I love you all, and I respect all of your political beliefs. If anyone shares their political beliefs in this class, I will ask you to stop sharing them, because this is not a political class. This is a Torah halacha-based class. We are going to discuss the sources, the Jewish view. This is, to the best of my ability, a totally unbiased Jewish perspective of what we think about abortion. And again, you are welcome to believe whatever you want. Politically, or you're even welcome to believe that Judaism thinks one way or the other, although you'll see at the end that I really don't think that's the case. But I do ask everyone to keep their own beliefs to themselves, and if you have anything to add intellectually to the discussion, please, but that does not include which candidates you voted for, and that does not include fall on the Roe v. Wade repealing decision. Okay, so with that said, so let's jump in and begin. So anyone know where abortion could be found in the Torah? Okay, Jim says not. Anyone have any thoughts? Maybe a little bit... Okay, so if you take a look at source number one, so there's a verse in the book of Shemos in Parshas Mishpatim that has nothing to do with abortion, but, as Jim correctly stated, but there is a clear indication that you might be able to draw about what we might think about abortion. Take a look inside. When two or more parties are fighting and one of them pushes a pregnant woman and a miscarriage results, but no other damage ensues, the one responsible shall be fined according as the woman's husband may exact, and the payments be based on reckoning. So what happens, this woman who has a miscarriage, what is the punishment for the person who causes the miscarriage? What does he have to do? He has to pay some money. So what, therefore, might you imply from this verse about the reality of the fetus in the womb? That it is valuable, but what kind of value? What is the punishment for murdering someone? Okay, good. So what is the punishment for accidental murder?
You go to the city
of refuge. Okay, good. Is the family allowed to kill that other person before they get to the city of refuge?
Yes, right.
Okay, so that's what we'd call probably a more severe level of punishment. Why is that not the case over here in this verse?
This is like bodily damage, doesn't it? Doesn't bodily damage to a person also wind up as a fine?
Okay, right. So it's bodily damage, but again, we're not only talking about the woman's body; we're talking about the fetus. And if you are going to make an implication and take an implication out of this verse, you might say the following: that is, when the Torah talks about the fetus, the assumption is that the only punishment that a person will be liable for if you damage and/or kill a fetus is not that you are considered a murderer, but rather that you're considered as if you harm someone. That essentially you'd view the fetus as like a limb on the woman's body, and okay, you accidentally gave it a potch and you hurt the woman a little bit, so you're not liable for murder, rather you're liable for harming her, and you have to pay accordingly. What this therefore does for us is that it gives us the only Torah verse that has anything to do with abortion or with the reality of the fetus in the womb, and it starts us off by seeming to imply that there is no reality in which Judaism will consider the fetus inside of a womb to be considered a life, or at least not a life on the same level as a human life, like each and every one of us sitting around the table or on Zoom, Baruch Hashem, breathing and taking in breaths. So that's not the same thing. And that seems to be a clear implication from what the Torah is trying to explain. That is the first source.
Can I say something?
Yeah, please.
It's an accident. It's not by the choice of the woman.
100%. So it's a total accident. But that said, accidental murder is treated quite severely in the Torah. And so the point is that this is not even being treated as an accidental murder. This is being treated as an accidental harming of one person.
Okay.
That's the difference. But fantastic point. Thank you.
Harming more the mother than the fetus.
Sorry?
Harming the mother more than harming the fetus in this case.
Right, but the point is that the punishment is not just because of harming the mother, it's harming the mother, which in turn also caused the miscarriage.
Yeah, but she was expecting to have a child and now she won't have the child.
Right. And so, but still...
Is there some compensation for the discomfort?
Okay, so you might say that the compensation she gets is for the discomfort. And again, that's a fair implication you can draw out as well. I am just trying to make the point that you might see it a little bit more broadly. But again, don't take my word for it. Let's keep looking at some of the sources to see how our rabbis understood this. So there are several different comments that our rabbis make about abortion. More often than not, it happens to be in a situation where the woman is in danger. And our rabbis seem to be quite clear about what we do if a woman is in danger and she has a fetus inside of her that is potentially harmful to her health. So take a look first in source number 2. It's a Mishnah in Ohalos, in which we're told as follows. If a woman is having trouble giving birth, then very simple, they cut up the child in her womb and brings it forth limb by limb, because her life comes before the life of the child. But if the greater part has come out, one may not touch it, for one may not set aside one person's life for that of another. So, according to this Mishnah, the rabbis are explicit in this specific case that if a woman is in danger at all from the fetus that is inside of her, then her life absolutely comes first, and if the baby has taken its breath, if the head is outside of the womb, and it's clear at this point that it's a real living life, then even if the mother's life is in danger, we do not allow the doctor or whatever to harm the child. It's now considered as you have two lives over here, and you have to make I want to say an educated guess, but a halachic educated guess as to whose life will be able to be more likely saved. But again, just in the womb and the child is a danger to the mother, then the mother's life comes first. The second rabbinic source that we have is in source number 3. It's the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Again, similar to this idea. And let's see what it says first. So the Gemara explains, Rav Chista raised an objection to Rav Huna from a Braisa. If a woman was giving birth and her life was being endangered by the fetus, the life of the fetus may be sacrificed in order to save the mother. But once his head has emerged during the birthing process, he may not be harmed in order to save the mother, because one life may not be pushed aside to save another life. So it's relatively similar to the first Mishnah that we just read before. Slight difference is that we are given a bit more of a bodily example. So the previous Mishnah that we said explained that a significant part of the body has to be out. The Hebrew language is yatsa rubo, that most of the body is out. Whereas the Gemara over here says no, even if just the head, even if just a breath is taken. But nonetheless, both these two first sources are very clear about only one case. I want to be very clear about this, that there is no implication that you could bring out of these cases, theoretically, for anything else, because this is a very clear case where the woman's life is in danger. If any implication would be brought out of this, what might you imply? That if we're allowed to, quote-unquote, kill the fetus to save the mother's life, what can we not do?
Kill the baby.
We can kill the baby in what circumstance?
When it's alive.
No, but let's say, but what? Sorry?
Can or cannot.
When would it be permissible? When would it not be permissible to kill the fetus? The fetus?
It's
birthing. So no, but let's say it's still inside. When would it not? When would you not be allowed? Again, this is all an implication, nothing explicit. So if our. Okay, so
kill the baby, then the mother lives. But if the mother dies and the baby lives, who's taking care of the baby?
Okay, good. So all good questions, but I'll take a step back for a second. The Gemara is very clear. If the woman's life is in danger when the baby is inside the womb, then you are allowed to kill the baby inside the womb. Again, it hasn't come out at all. You're allowed to kill the baby inside the womb in order to save the mother's life. What happens if the mother's life is not in danger, but she does not want to keep the baby? It doesn't address that, but again, if you do want to be a thinking person, what might you imply? I'm not saying, it's even if you don't agree with the implication, what might you imply? So you might...
Yeah. Somebody else takes care of that baby.
So okay, maybe I'm totally wrong here, but you might imply that the only time it would be permissible to harm the fetus inside the womb would be in a circumstance when the woman's life is in danger. However, if her life was not in danger, and again, there could be a broad range of defining what that means, her life being in danger, but perhaps if her life is not in danger at all, and you choose not to want to have this baby for a million other reasons under the sun, that would not be permissible. That could be a theoretical implication that we can make out of this statement of the Gemara.
Can you take the statement?
Could also make an implication. I'm not sure. I think this your whole life. But could there also be an implication that even while the baby is inside, if it's viable, like when they say Rubel, or when the head is emerged, are they trying to say when the fetus has reached the point of independent viability?
So seemingly not. Otherwise the Gemara would have said that, right? That so you can go back and forth about this. You could. Say again? Right. Okay, good. Good. Okay, so you might want to say that once you reach the point of viability was really the language that Chazal was going for, but it could be that they didn't really have that notion, that the only thing that they would have as viability is once the baby actually comes out. However, nowadays, if viability, let's say, is, what's the earliest baby that has survived? Anyone know? Like 20, like very pretty early. Once you reach a point of scientific viability, then perhaps at that point, even if the baby is not out of the womb, Melissa is telling us that you might want to imply that even that would not be allowed to abort, even if the baby is not breathing fresh air. Okay, good.
If the language here in the English is true to the Hebrew, the life of the fetus may be sacrificed. That seems to suggest that the fetus has some agency as a life.
Okay.
Even in the womb.
Don't always believe what you read. However, if we take a look at the next source, there is a lot more that you can take out of the language itself. So we're only going to look at the bolded part in source number 4. So it says, a baby boy, even one who is one day old, then skip to the next bolded part, and one who kills him is liable for his murder, as it says, and he that smites any man mortally shall be put to death, meaning any man including a child who is one day old. So according to this Mishnah, if one murders a child who is one day old, you are liable for death. What if you murder a child that is -3 days old, still in the womb? Doesn't apply. Again, so seemingly, if we are to imply theoretically from the previous sources that when the baby reaches the point of viability, which could maybe even be as early as 21 weeks, that unless there is a clear reason to save the mother, that even in that circumstance you wouldn't be able to harm the fetus. Well, over here it would be the exact opposite, because over here perhaps the Mishnah is implying for us that the only time it is considered murder of a baby is when the baby is one day old. But if the baby is less than one day old, then by all means it's not considered murder, and whatever you need to do to for any other reason under the sun might theoretically be permissible. Good so far? Everyone on the same page? More or less? We all agree politically? Great. Okay, so if you take a look at source number 5, it is I'll say another statement that our rabbis make, and so take a look. In the case of a pregnant woman who is taken by the court to be executed, the court does not wait to execute her until she gives birth. Rather, she is killed immediately. Okay, so our rabbis clearly were not bothered by killing a pregnant woman, even though it meant harming a fetus. If the woman was liable for the death penalty, then the child in her womb was subsumed under that death penalty. Again, did that child really deserve that? Unclear, but the rabbis did not care about the child that was in her womb. She had to go ahead and face the reality of the punishment that she was deserving of. Finally, before we break past the times of the rabbis in the Gemara, take a look at two more sources in 6 and in 7. So 6 is an additional Gemara in which the rabbis are very explicit about the dealing of a fetus. However, this has nothing to do with Jewish people, but rather all the other nations of the world. And as we'll see towards the end of the class, there is a real difference halachically between a Jewish person doing an abortion, a Jewish doctor doing an abortion versus a non-Jewish person doing an abortion. It all surrounds this Gemara over here in source number 6. It's stated in the book of Agadot that the sages said in the name of Rabbi Yishmael that a descendant of Noach is executed even for killing fetuses. So, right, a descendant of Noach, a ben Noach, that means someone who is not Jewish. That's code for not Jewish. So this individual, if they harm a fetus in any way, shape, or form, so this person is going to be liable just as much as if they were to harm any other person on planet Earth who is living and breathing. And so this Gemara seems to be quite clear that a non-Jewish person may not perform an abortion at all under any circumstances, lest they want to be labeled a murderer. Again, is there more to see? Absolutely. But that is the clearest source that we've had so far. And then finally, in source number 7, this is probably the most famous of Jewish sources that get quoted in reference to abortion in general and how we view a child or a fetus in the womb. And that is, if you take a look at the bold at the conclusion of source number 7, and if she is pregnant until 40 days from conception, the fetus is merely water. It is not yet considered a living being, and therefore does not disqualify its mother from partaking of truma, right? So ignore the technicalities over here about truma, but the implication is quite clear. It's not even an implication, it's just a fact that Chazal tell us that the first 40 days after conception, it's not even considered any sort of like an actual baby. It's really, they call it mayim ba'alma, just water, but it's just a clump of cells. And it's true, if you look at an ultrasound that early on, it's really just like a gestational sac or something along those lines. It's really, there's no human form there. And in fact, there are other Gemaras that talk about that gender is not even decided until past 40. Gender is decided before this 40-day mark. And it's clear that Chazal see these first 40 days in conception after conception as significant to the formation of life. And afterwards, there is a much clearer indicator that life might be there after 40 days, but beforehand, there is not as much of a clear argument that life truly exists in the classical sense, so much so that I'm going to share something that I do not agree with for multiple levels, but it is worthwhile to be aware of. So there was an individual that I know quite well, or at least I should say I used to know quite well, that was interviewed on a podcast both the man and the woman in this marriage, she had a lot of mental health issues, and she found out she was pregnant with her third child, and she had a lot of stress and depression and many other mental health complications that happened after the birth of both of her children, and they simply were not ready for a third child, and they decided that since the pregnancy test was positive within the first 40 days of conception, they decided to get an abortion without even asking a rabbinic opinion, because of this Gemara. Again, do I agree with that conclusion? No, for many reasons, but that was the conclusion they drew from this idea. And while it's not, never really recommended to just go ahead and make an assumption from one Gemara, because because as you see, there are several different Gemaras, and we have to understand which one we follow more nowadays. There is a very strong statement that we find over here with this notion of the first 40 days, the fetus being just considered a sack of water, in a sense. Okay, so with all of this said, anyone want to take a crack at trying to summarize all of the various rabbinic opinions that we've seen thus far in sources 2 through 7? What might you conclude that our rabbis say in the Gemara about abortion? Is a woman who is in danger allowed to get an abortion? Seemingly, yes, as long as the baby is still inside. If it's any sort of a risk to her health, absolutely. Is a woman who is not able to care for the child financially allowed to get an abortion from our rabbi's perspective in the Gemara?
There's no comment.
No comment, but again, what might you imply? Too soon to imply anything. I'm asking. Okay, well, I mean, listen, if you really want to push me, you could tell me, well, you can make the argument that maybe financial stability also indicates mental health stability, that a person who is not able to be financially stable, maybe they're not able to be mentally stable, and we know mental health is becoming much more accepted as an indicator for a person being able to move forward in life, and so maybe you can make the statement that financial stability would even indicate, Maurice, maybe just mute. Maybe you can make the argument that financial stability would be an indicator or a necessity for allowing a woman to get an abortion because she can make the argument that it's not good for her long-term health. I need to do it? Oh, okay. Sorry, 1 second, everyone. Okay, so with that said, again, I'm not arguing that this could be the case. All I'm doing is simply making a potential implication from the sources we've seen thus far. With all of this said, now let's go into the medieval era. What did the rabbis in the medieval times think about abortion? And you'll see that the tone of the conversation totally shifts from the time of the Gemara. The time of the Gemara, there was very clearly a tone of, if the woman is in danger, no issue, and otherwise, I would even go so far as to say that the rabbis seemed somewhat parve and not actually forceful in any other case. Rather, they were simply saying that if a woman is in danger, then you can do something about the fetus. And this might just be a historic reality in terms of where medicine was at the time. That unless the woman's life was in danger, then medically they didn't really have any options. But if the woman's life, if the woman's life was in danger, then they would do whatever they needed to do because she was going to die anyway, so they would try to save her life. However, if her life wasn't in danger, then the thought of just opting to do something was just not a medically viable way of doing things, and so therefore, that could be why the options seem limited in the times of the Gemara. As we move forward...
Sorry? There's no rape cases or incest cases. In the
Gemara, there do not seem to be any cases like that. Again, we'll get to that towards the end, but in the times of the Gemara, that wasn't the case. Understand also that biblically speaking, the Gemara, the Torah has the very complicated case about a woman who is raped or seduced, that she is... that she should or that she is allowed to marry the man who did that. Because, again, in society in those times, she would be considered, in a sense, damaged goods. And there would be a necessity for her to marry, it's crazy to say in 2022, but for her to marry her rapist because he would be the man who she would be able to find. And he is obligated to marry her. So just understand culturally and sociologically just different times. I saw another hand that was up. No?
Oh, I'll raise mine.
Okay.
So pregnancy was, up until 100 years or so ago, that in itself was a danger to the woman.
Absolutely. Even
a regular, normal pregnancy, there was a pretty high chance of the woman dying.
Yep.
So we're looking at this from the view of the modern woman, you know, where being pregnant is not all that dangerous.
Right. So,
to the people who were writing in the Middle Ages here, it was inherently dangerous to the woman.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe the implication you're saying is that since danger was much more likely in pregnancy back in the day, for all we know, the case that the Gemara is talking about, in which we're saying a woman might be in danger, is quite common, and therefore maybe abortion happened, or some version of abortion happened much more frequently than we would imagine. Okay, good. Could be. Okay, so let's go further now. I want to share with you essentially three different sources, four different sources from the Middle Ages that all begin to paint a very clear picture of what the rabbis are going to do with this in the future of Judaism. So let's take a look first at source number 8. And again, I apologize, the English isn't here, but we'll just translate the single bolded line in Hebrew. So the Ramban, Nachmanides, tells us, V'dafka ben yom echad aval ubar lo delo karina bein nefesh adam. So going on that previous statement, I think, of the Mishnah that we had before, the notion of killing a one-day-old baby. So the Ramban says that, yes, it's true. To kill a one-day-old baby is going to be an issue, but he says explicitly to kill a fetus who is still in the womb, even if it's fully viable, as long as it's still in the womb, it's not called a nefesh adam, it's not called the soul of a human being, and therefore, seemingly, the being inside of the womb is much more permissible to do something to that, to abort or something of the like, because of the fact that it is not considered a nefesh and not considered a soul. If you take a look, however, in source number 9 in Rashi, he says as follows. Again, we'll do the same. We'll read the Hebrew and then translate. To quote in the bolded, to kol zman shelo yatzala avir haolam lav nefeshu, that as long as the baby, as long as the fetus has not come out into the air of the world, then it's not considered a soul, right? So how might you understand this? It might be that we're to understand that the soul that God puts into every person is actually not imbued within any of us until the baby comes out of the womb. And that would actually make a lot of sense. Someone bring me a comparison and a proof that maybe a fetus does not receive a soul until after it leaves the body.
Isn't that what happened with Adam?
So the very first person, Adam, so when he became a full-fledged person, it's when God breathed life into him, and the assumption is that that means that his soul was sort of placed in him. So it could be that that's what happens every single time a child is born. Maybe there is no soul of the child in the womb, and it only is given a soul once it takes its first breath after it leaves the womb. There are a lot of implications of that if that were to be the case. And so again, what's the answer? We don't really know. It could be yes, it could be no. But that could be one way of looking at it based on what Rashi is explaining over here, because he says, again, this idea that the soul, the child is not considered a life force with a soul until after it takes a breath. V'nitan lahargo l'hatzil es imo. And one is allowed to kill this fetus in the womb in order to save the mother. Aval yatsa rosho, ein nogim b'lahargo, but if the head popped out, the birthing process has already begun, then you can't touch the child. You can't kill the child. We have no right to kill the child once it already started to come out, even if it is endangering the life of the mother, because of the fact that it's one life over another, and that becomes much more complicated. It's not as black and white, simple, as if the child was still in the womb. So according to the Ramban, Nachmanides, and Rashi, very clear that the fetus in the womb is not considered a nefesh, it's not considered a soul, so aborting it is much more permissible, but once it leaves the womb, then it becomes much more complicated. That seems to be relatively in line with what our rabbi said in the times of the Gemara. However, take a look at source number 10. Source number 10 is Tosfos. This is the classic, one of the major classic Ashkenaz sources that we follow in this day and age. And Tosfos says that the conclusion of his paragraph discussing this notion of aborting and the like, he says in the bolded, V'yesh lomar, Tahan nami bi Yisrael mitzvah kidei lahatzil ve'efshar d'afilo be'ovei kochavim shari. So this becomes very complicated. Essentially, what he is seemingly trying to hold one second. I apologize. Okay, this is not the Tosfot that I had intended to include. So the Tosfot over here seems to imply a similar idea as to what both Rashi and the Ramban are indicating. Again, that is that to save the mother is permissible as long as the child is inside the womb. And finally, again, in source number 11, the Rambam, Maimonides, also says similarly, V'im mishahotzi rosho enogin bo she'in doche nefesh mepnei nefesh. That at the end of the day, unless the baby is out of the womb, one cannot, as long as the baby is out of the womb, you can't harm the baby, but while it's still in the womb, it is an issue. And the Shulchan Aruch seems to paskin similarly in source number 12. This, therefore, shows us that in the times of the Torah, in the times of the Gemara, in medieval times as well, there were very limited cases, as was pointed out before, as to where abortion might truly come up, because again, medicine was much more severely limited. However, it seems clear that there are certain red lines that can't be crossed, or that there are absolutely clearly red lines that could be crossed if need be, and namely, if the woman is in danger. It's not until the 1500s that there were two teshuvot, there were two responsa that were written by the Maharit. The Maharit was Rabbi Yosef Ditrani. He was a rabbi from Greece. And he offers two teshuvot that all of modern Jewish responsa on this issue are based off of. And they are extensively long teshuvot. But I bring here two captions from his teshuvot in sources 13 and sources 14 that will be a guiding force for us as we try and understand what the modern perspective of abortion is. He makes two points. Take a look at source number 13. He writes, "Dehad the aser midin chavalahu." His explanation and justification of what abortion is, of what the harm done to a fetus in the womb is simply chavala. What is chavala? It's it's attacking someone. So am I allowed to go and punch Maurice in the face? Sorry, Maurice. Am I allowed to go punch Maurice in the face? No. Absolutely, I'm not allowed to go punch Maurice in the face. What's worse, punching Maurice in the face or shooting Maurice? Sorry. What's worse? Right, so shooting him is probably not good, especially if it, God forbid, led to the unfortunate end. So we see from this teshuva, from source number 13, that there are two different models of what a person can do to another individual. One, you can kill them, or two, you can hurt them. Neither one of these things are permissible, but there is a clear difference between the two. Namely, if there is a necessity to hurt another person, right, and there could be many reasons why it would be necessary to hurt someone or punch someone in the face, perhaps. So there are many circumstances where that might be allowed. However, killing is very, very limited and often not allowed. And so therefore, if we consider harming the fetus, just chavala, just the same as harming another person, it's clear that there could be many leniencies when it comes to abortion. Because again, are you allowed to cause harm to someone else, to even mildly help save someone else? Theoretically, right? Again, it's hard to imagine a case of where that would be applicable other than abortion. But most people are not going to feel better if Maurice gets, well, maybe some people will feel better if Marisa, it's just because you're right in front of me, that's why you have to be the example. But abortion could be a great case where a woman who is struggling in any way, shape, or form on the spectrum of health, to just financial needs or maybe just family planning. Maybe she just never thought of herself as being a person who was going to have X amount of children, and she doesn't want another one. And so if it's just, chavala, if it's just equivalent to punching someone in the face, so then maybe it's not going to be an issue. That is the first teshuva of the Ma'arit. The second teshuva is source number 14, and this is kind of where everything explodes from this statement. He explains, Alma b'shvil nivul ha'im horgim havlad b'yadayim v'lo chashu mishum ibud nefashos. That when it comes to anyone want to try either in person or on Zoom land, want to try to translate what the words nivul ha'im mean, I'll translate the whole line except for those words, and then maybe someone will take a crack at trying to translate it. So he says that for the sake of nivul ha'im, we are allowed to kill the child, and we are allowed to kill the fetus, and we don't have to be concerned that it would be considered like actual murder. Anyone want to take a crack at what nivul ha'im means? Certainly doesn't mean the black and white danger that the Gemara was referring to for the mother. It's something else. Okay, everyone's afraid to talk now. So I'll translate it as best as I can. It's really not so clear. So nivel is from the word, from like the term nivel peh. Anyone ever hear that term? It's like if you speak like not appropriately, like you curse or you whatever. That's called nivel peh. It's like a disgusting way to talk. So nivel means like disgust. Ha'im is the mother. So it's the disgust of the mother. So therefore, what this means is, if we have the ability to prevent the disgust of the mother, then we are allowed to kill the child, allowed to kill the fetus, and we do not have to be concerned with this being considered actual murder. So what does that mean?
Well, it seems to me incest or rape would fall in that category where it might disgust the mother to bear the child.
Okay, good. So this is a fantastic possibility that when we're talking about a real case where the union was just absolutely disgusting to the woman, so she maybe would allow abortion. What other things might be considered in disgust of the mother? Right. Okay. Good. Incest, rape. Good. What else?
It was known that the child couldn't survive. It was born.
A disability.
Okay. Good. Right. A disability. Absolutely. Tay-Sachs babies. All right. Rahmana Litzlan. There are many scenarios where the doctors are able to determine that the baby will either have a horrible quality of life or whatever it might be, and so perhaps that is disgusting to the mother. We understand what that means in this context, and mother would never want their child to have to experience this, so maybe that would be permissible. What else?
Maybe if birth control fails.
Sorry?
If a birth control fails.
Okay, good. Right. So it could be as broadly defined as the mother didn't want another child. It's disgusting. She didn't want it doesn't sound so nice to say, but again, since the Maharit did not define this any further, you might want to say that as long as it's disgusting for her, maybe it's just a subjective term. All the woman has to say to the rabbi, this baby disgusts me, and bada bing, bada boom, you get an abortion. Maybe it's as simple as that. It's not as simple as that, but maybe it is, or it should be, as simple as that. Okay, with that said, I want to share with you one additional source from around the 1700s, and then we're going to talk about contemporary times in terms of how the rabbis deal with this nowadays. So if you take a look at source number 15, it's the Sheilat Yavetz. He explained, one of the major rabbanim of the time in the 1700s, and he was given this explicit case of Shesheilat im yish isur lekalkel ubar bebeten imo shezinta. Let's say you have a woman who there's a lot of possibilities of what zinta means. It's like an illicit relationship. It could be that she was a single girl that had a relationship when she was unwed. Certainly in those times it was really it was very frowned upon. Or it could be a woman who had an affair. Or it could be a woman who was raped. It could be anything. Some sort of an illicit relationship. Can you abort that child? This is what the Yavetz was asked in source number 15. And he says in the bold at the end, V'gam b'ubar kasher hayat sad l'hakel l'tzorech gadol. There is room, he explains, that one can be lenient. If it is greatly necessary to do that, kol kama d'lo akar. Afilu enu mishum pikuach nefesh imo. Even if if it is not a life or death situation for the mother, if there is a clear need, then perhaps there is something you could do. Ela lahatzila meraato, right? So you just need to save her from this difficulty that she is experiencing. Shagorev la ka'iv gadol. Because what's the situation over here? She was raped, or she had an affair, or whatever it might be. This fetus is going to cause her great difficulty in life, and so therefore there is tremendous room to be lenient, and therefore, again, the baby is going to be fine and viable, theoretically, other than her being a little embarrassed. Nothing wrong with this birth, but the Yavitz was incredibly lenient. But he does say, if it's Sarach Ian, we have to look further into this. That's like rabbinic code for I don't know what to tell you. You know, go take a hike, because it's too complicated to answer. But nonetheless, he does seemingly come out at the end of the day being very lenient over here in a case of necessity that, again, is not the physical safety of the mother, but it is beyond. It's sort of like the mental health of the mother, or however you might define the situation, or a woman finds herself in a very difficult illicit relationship that ended up concluding with a child being conceived. Okay, with that...
Can I make an observation?
Sure. That's right. Welcome to Judaism.
That makes me frustrated, quite honestly, because I don't understand how you can say on the beginning, too bad, what I hear, so please bear with me, it's one of those, well, too bad, so sad, if you have to, you have to have the child, on one hand, and on the other hand, you're saying if you have a fetus that isn't, that you decide and you can kill the fetus and that's okay, but if it's a little out and you're going through the birth, then you have to keep the baby regardless. And now you're saying that you have a choice. And I can appreciate that each rabbi is a little different, but how do you know in either times like this, thousands, hundreds of years ago, whatever, and present day, how do you know which is correct right now?
So,
we're not talking about politics here. We're talking about a woman's life versus a baby's life, and now you can choose, but now last time you can't choose?
Right. Okay, so it's a fantastic point, and thank you for bringing it up. The simple answer is that this is the reason why it's not meant to be, that this class is not meant to be one in which you should form an explicit conclusion for any one person's individual case. That's number one. And number two, even though we've synopsized this into 40 minutes, it's an incredibly extensive topic, and it's not nearly as black and white as I've explained it thus far. In other words, the sources that I have shared are black and white, but there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of other texts that we could explore to help understand how we get from point A to point B. So even though there are things that seem to contradict, what I would stress is that it's not like one person is saying the sky is blue and another person is saying the sky is green. Is that this person said the sky is blue, then someone after him said the sky may be like a little bit light blue, and then eventually, enough generations and enough teshuvot written back and forth later, so you get to the point where A is blue and B is green, but there was a lot of in between. So that was like a really simplistic way of saying that it's just kind of like an incredibly complex topic. That is, if we want to do this properly, and if anyone would like to learn this much more in depth, then we could have a Yom Iyun, a day of learning from morning to night, and then maybe we can cover a third of the sources on this. But this is meant to be just a sort of a brief overview. But the point is well taken, Marit, and I appreciate you making it. Okay, so let's see two final sources that, again, these are the contemporary rabbis, the two major contemporary poskim who have ruled in this matter. The first is the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Woldenberg, one of the great rabbanim in Israel of the 20th century, and that's in source number 16. And then in source number 17, we have Rav Moshe Feinstein, who I think is probably somewhat well known to most of us, and that is, he's, of course, the great American rabbi, decisor of halakha of the 20th century, living in New York. And so they have two very distinct perspectives that both go into the modern day decision of deciding whether or not it is permissible for a woman to get an abortion. So let's take a look inside again, only overview and not fully deeply inside. But if you take a look at the bolded words in source number 16, he says as follows. This is the Tzitz Eliezer. Efshar lehatir hafsakas harayon ad shiva chadashim. He permits in extreme circumstances an abortion for a woman who is up to 7 months pregnant. Uba ofen should be bitsua hafsakas harayon lo yehei karach b'shum sakana la'im. He says, however, that if there is any danger to the mother, then this notion goes totally out the window. But assuming that you can keep the mother totally safe, then one is allowed to do an abortion up to 7 months. Mishiva chadashim v'hala hadavar kvar yoter chamor. However, he says, after 7 months, then it becomes much more stringent, and it is not as, quote-unquote, simple. Mikivan shebemalos zayin chadashim bakvar havalad beharbei mikrim lidei gamru. Right, so he says, once you reach 7 months, that's like a real baby. To do an abortion after that is much more complicated. Again, the Tzitz Eliezer was not dealing with medical science in the 1600s. He was in the 20th century. However, we've obviously made tremendous strides, even in the last 20 years. But nonetheless, he makes this clear point that 7 months is really the cutoff point. Up until 7 months, there is a tremendous room for leniency. After those 7 months, then it becomes much more complicated. And this is the source for many leniencies in many significant circumstances one can find themselves, well, hopefully that no one finds themselves in, but that could happen. And in particular, take some more implications out of that after we see source number 17. So source number 17 is Rav Moshe Feinstein. And again, to say that they are in disagreement is not entirely truthful. They're rather coming at this from different perspectives. The Tzitz Eliezer was explaining that if you want to have an abortion, here is when it becomes really problematic, but before this point, it's not. And Rav Moshe is explaining almost like objectively, here is how Judaism does view abortion. He says, Ika iser ritzicha milot tirzach gamal uber. So he says there is a prohibition, even though it seems to be counter to everything we've said thus far, there is a prohibition of thou shalt not kill that applies even to the fetus. Virak shepator ha-horgo mimisa. However, there is one difference, and this is the nuance that we have been picking up the entire time. It's not that it's not considered murder, it's just that one is not punishable as a murderer if they do kill a fetus. So, thou shalt not kill, that means you can't kill a 50-year-old person and you can't kill a fetus. However, punishment for murder only applies for killing someone out of the womb and not someone in the womb. The asur lahargo af lepikuach nefesh, and it's forbidden to kill a fetus even for the sake of saving a life. To kol inshe virak lahatzalas imos. All right, let's say someone tells you you have to abort that fetus, otherwise I'm going to shoot that person. That's totally prohibited, he says. What is allowed? If the mother's life is in significant danger from the fetus itself, and the fetus is causing the danger, then you can save the mother then and only then. Shelo tamas b'leidaso, so that she should not die in childbirth. Hu haheter. That's where the great leniency comes from. V'lo b'shvil shum tzorech ta'im shezeh aser b'pshitos. However, he says that saving the mother means what you think saving the mother should be. The mother is in danger because the child is harmful for the mother for whatever reason. However, any other extraneous matter, which I use that word in quotations, right? So anything else that is not black and white, that would not be permissible to allow an abortion in such a situation. And therefore, Rav Moshe comes out incredibly harshly, strongly against abortion in nearly any circumstance. So essentially, really what we find ourselves in as a final concluding point, is that Judaism, is Judaism pro-life or is Judaism pro-choice? Well, the answer is that that's like way overly simplistic. The truth is that there are circumstances where abortion is allowed, and there are circumstances where abortion is not allowed. Certainly the notion of being totally cavalier with aborting a fetus just because that is not something that Judaism promotes, but at the same time, the notion that Judaism is as pro-life as some of the camps out there, that's also a misnomer. Rather, as with Judaism always, there is an incredible amount of nuance and there is an incredible amount of gray, and that if a person does find themselves in this circumstance for the necessity of an abortion, for whatever it might be, then a rabbi should be consulted. And I have one specific case that I'll share. A very good friend and colleague of mine was brought a case, a young girl in his shul who was pretty far along in her pregnancy. She was a good Beis Yaakov girl. Not such a good Beis Yaakov girl, but she was a Beis Yaakov girl, and she was in a right-wing family, and she had had a relationship with a boy, and she was pregnant, and having a child would essentially mean that her life was ruined for various reasons. And in this specific circumstance, which again, nothing to extrapolate from, but just to explain with, that in this specific circumstance, she was given the permission to get an abortion, mostly because of the emotional fallout that would come. And this was not some quack rabbi. I'm happy to talk offline who the rabbi was, but it was a major rabbi in our community who gave this leniency for this specific case. And essentially, it comes from all of the collection in the compendium of sources that we've seen, that there are many reasons to be lenient and many reasons to not be lenient. And it is a case-by-case basis, but it is, as we said, totally gray and not black and white at all. And so with that, I want to briefly cover two more points. The first is, and we're not going to see this inside, but I did bring two interesting articles, excerpts from articles, sources number 18 and 19. Source number 8, the article in 18, I don't really agree with, and if you don't understand why, I'll just explain, because source number 18 makes the point, I think it makes the point that the notion of not having of the notion of illegalizing abortion is totally anti-Judaism, and so I don't really necessarily agree with that, so that's why I don't like source number 18, but again, feel free to see that inside. Source number 19 is really a wonderful article written by Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg. I'm sure many of us in this room might know who he is. He's the rabbi in Boca Raton Synagogue, and he basically said it best in the conclusion of the article that's in bold. He says, "When it comes to Roe v. Wade, by all means have your political position, and please pursue what your religion says. But I beg you, don't hide behind your religion to advance your politics." And this is talking to any of the people who say that, oh, my religion, again, whether it's Jewish, Christian, whatever, and again, I don't understand fully the Christian beliefs, and I'm not here to speak about Christianity, I'm here to speak about Judaism, but Judaism is very gray, so you have plenty of people out there who say that, oh, I am a from Jew, I'm a religious Jew, and therefore that means I have to be pro-life or pro-choice, whatever it is, and they're both wrong, and that's just not what Judaism believes. Again, it's just not that black and white. There is one final point, and that's in source number 20 that we'll just do outside, and it goes to the question, out of all the sources, this is the one I'm most weary of sharing, but I always like to share what's out there. And so this goes to the question of the my body, my choice reality in the world that we live in. And the question is, do we believe in my body, my choice? And essentially, again, we're just short on time, so we're not going to go into it now. But essentially, Rabbi Shlomo Zevin, in a fantastic piece called Mishpat Shylock, yes, he's referring to the Shylock that you probably are familiar familiar with. And essentially, he makes the point that we don't believe in my body, my choice, for one very simple reason. Because we don't believe that we own our bodies. We believe that our bodies are on loan from God. And that has tremendous sweeping implications to say that how we eat and how we drink and how we sleep and how we act, all of these things it's incumbent upon us to realize that we don't own our bodies, and therefore one should be careful to act accordingly, to realize their body is on loan from God. So the notion that someone is the owner of their body and therefore gets to make the decision, that's not entirely a Jewish perspective, and I am a little weary of that comment. But again, not just because of abortion, but really across the board, it just it's not really a very Jewish thing to say. With all that said, I hope I presented this without offending too many people. I'm going to turn off the recording. I'm happy to take any questions privately or publicly, but thank you all for listening and wish everyone a beautiful night.